Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
I'm Rob Sivak, in for Tom Hall, and it's Midday at the Movies. Today we're going to be talking about summer movies and some of the exciting new animation technologies in films like Toy Story 4. Our favorite movie mavens, Maryland Film Festival founding director Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post, will suggest some of their favorite summer flicks, and we'll ask you to tell us which films are brightening up your summer. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Roald Dahl's Matilda at Olney Theater Center. That's all coming up on Midday right after the news. Welcome to another edition of Midday at the Movies, our monthly look at notable new films and trends in filmmaking, and I'm joined once again by our esteemed friends and movie mavens, Anne Hornaday, film critic for The Washington Post and author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Her 2017 bestseller, which, as we enjoy reminding everyone, is so good that it's now available in paperback. Oh, nice to see you again.
It were so, Rob. Thank you so much.
Well, we can hope. And with
it's a seller, let's put it that
yeah,
way.
It's selling.
It's a seller.
Okay. Yeah. Well, whatever. And with us through the miracle of mobile telephony is the founder and former director of the Maryland Film Festival, Jed Dietz. Hi, Jed.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Now, when you told me you're vacationing this week in Marfa, I first thought that was your shorthand for one of your favorite vacation retreats, Martha's Vineyard. But when you spelled it out, M-A-R-F-A, I understood that you meant the little West Texas town of Marfa, which yes. which I've learned is quite an artistic hotspot. What's going on down there?
Well, it is on the map now because the great artist Donald Judd discovered it in the 60s, bought up a bunch of buildings with help from some philanthropists and a foundation or two, and really made it an art center. I'm standing in the middle, actually, of one of his installations. And John Chamberlain, Robert Irwin, Dan Flavin, I mean, he attracted a lot of artists here. It's yeah. now attracted, movie making. It goes back to the days of we're staying in a hotel where Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Taylor, and George Stevens stayed in, and James Dean stayed in when they were filming Giant.
Is that the Gauge?
And just recently, Jill Soloway has done a series called I Love Dick that all takes place in Marfa.
Wow.
So we're. It is, you know, 3 hours from El Paso. I mean, it's really in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, and it's kind of a surreal landscape with in spots where Donald Judd's these big rectangular forms that he does, and that was his specialty, I guess. He's got them sitting out there under the Texas sky all over the place, right?
Yeah, he had studied architecture and was a great fan of architecture, and so the placement of these works is just as important to him as it would be when you put a building down. And it's extraordinary. It's an amazing thing to see.
Yeah. Well, we're glad to have you with us, Jed, and we'll enjoy all the artistic West Texas karma that comes in from the line. And we're going to talk about summer movies today. And we want to know what movies you've been seeing this summer or planning to see. You can join us by giving us a call at 410-662-8780. You can email us at midday@wypr.org, or you can send us a tweet at @midday_wypr. So Anne, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is that we've got all of these unusual animations that are in release now. And, and of course, next week we've got the remake of Lion King coming up.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was interesting to me how this technology has been advancing by leaps and bounds.
Incredible. And we're really seeing the fruits of it this summer. Toy Story 4, which has really done extraordinarily well, amidst a rather down season, I might add. I mean, this has been the summer of sequels, and not all of them have done well. As a matter of fact, a lot of them have done very poorly because they weren't executed very well. But Toy Story 4 is this bright and shining light, I think, in large part because of the advances in animation, just as a visual experience. I mean, it's a wonderful story, and there's great character development and some wonderful new characters. And I don't want to dismiss that, because that's hugely important. But just as a purely aesthetic and visual experience, it is so dazzling and so rich and so pleasing. It's just a beautiful eye bath, you know? I mean, yeah. The way that they've... The sophistication of their color work and the light.
Now, this is Pixar.
Pixar,
right?
Our yeah. friends at Pixar.
And Jon Favreau is the director?
No, Jon Favreau actually directed The Lion King.
Lion King. But he also did, I was thinking of Jungle Book, wasn't he?
Correct,
yeah.
Exactly, which was a great advance at that time. But now this new Lion King, which I happened to see yesterday and have now been liberated to talk about, because the embargo just lifted minutes ago,
ooh,
folks.
Ooh.
But it is just, again, leaps, like to your point, leaps and bounds. I mean, the detail of the light, the movement of the fur, the movement of the animals. I mean,
it's hyper-realism.
It's hyper, yeah. I'm searching for this new word, because it's not photorealism, because there's no photography. It's all computer-generated. We've been calling this a live-action remake, but it's not. There's no live act. I think there might be one scene that was photographed live. It's all computer-generated, but it is so just startlingly realist that it's really quite gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. But you're still finding the celebrity voices.
Yeah.
That's still...
Yeah, some of which work better than others. But and it is it's a beat-for-beat remake of the 94 cartoon, which is fine because it was a wonderful, you know, I mean, why mess with success? But it, you know, they've added a couple of songs.
James Earl Jones is back.
He is sure back, and he is just magnificent.
As the voice of
just
King
magnificent
Mufasa.
Is yeah. Mufasa. And Alfre Woodard plays Mrs. Mufasa. I can't remember her name right now. And of course, Beyonce is Nala, and Donald Glover is Simba. To me, the scene stealers were really Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner as Pumbaa and Timon.
Right.
I mean, they're just hilarious and great. But just visually, though, it is stunning. It's just spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think we're really seeing something a barrier has been crossed here. It's almost to where I was thinking on the way in. I'm not even sure where they're going to put Lion King in terms of Oscar category, because it's this animation. You know, it's almost its own thing now. It's beyond, animation has almost transcended itself.
Now, Jed, do you think that there's a potential for this technology to bleed into other kinds of, sort of adult films? Is there a place, or in action films, are we going to see a crop of this sort of hyper-realistic, I guess it's motion capture types of technologies used for other storytelling?
Yeah, I think we're already seeing it. I mean, we've, in the great action films, you know, they've been going into, they don't call it animation, they call it CGI, but I mean, there are, you know, they're laden with these effects that have gotten, by the way, better and better, just as Anne was describing with this new groundbreaking work that Disney and Pixar have done with Lion King. And Lion King, it's so interesting what Anne is saying, because I think even if you've just seen one or two of the trailers that they've been using, it's such a fascinating real-life version of the cartoon, except, of course, it is a cartoon by any normal definitions, digitally done, but in a completely different way. And I think also Anne's point on Toy Story 4, and I love the whole series. I think, you know, the Toy Story sequels have been strong and character-driven, as Anne said, and beautifully written, great character scripts, and developing new storylines that fit the core mission of the whole concept from Toy Story 1, and this one does that, and it introduces new characters. And I think by the end of this movie, you'll be moved.
Yeah.
But the animation, you almost, even with Toy Story now, you almost, which is pure animation in the old Disney sense, you know, the old Mickey Mouse sense. You almost have to use another term, because even using just the four Toy Story the arc of that animation from the beginning to this fourth one, it's at a whole other level.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not enough of a technician to be able to describe what got us there, but they've lifted the animation to a whole other level, despite, you know, in addition to keeping a story and characters that we've grown to love very much alive and fresh.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's all. And I was just going to say, Lion King is walking across the bridge that you just described, Rob, which is it is posing as, and I don't mean anybody's deceiving it because they've been very clear what it is, but it's posing as a documentary almost, shot outdoors with live animals, which of course it's not. But I mean, and that was the thing it was adding to the cartoon story of Lion King, and I might add also the Broadway show. So it's fascinating, this technology.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to go back and give our listeners a sample of the Toy Story 4 sequel experience. And here Woody is introducing this new character named Forky to the gang of toys. And there are some kind of existential questions that Forky raises, and we'll talk about that later. Go ahead.
Everyone, Bonnie made a friend in class.
She's already making friends.
No, she literally made a new friend. I want you to meet Forky.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
He's a spork.
Yes, yeah, I know. Forky is the most important toy to Bonnie right now. We all have to make sure nothing happens to him.
Why am I alive?
You're Bonnie's toy. You are going to help create happy memories that will last for the rest of her life.
Huh? What?
Oh, yeah.
That's Tom Hanks as Woody and Forky, a very interesting kind of character to be introduced.
The great Tony Hale, voiced by the great Tony Hale.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a wonderful creation, and it just reminds me of the Pixar motto or ethos is that they don't even start to film anything until they have the script utterly perfect. I mean, they are so story and character driven that they will labor for years over it to make sure it's correct. And that development of a new character like Sporky, they're, you know, it looks easy and it looks like it was just, you know, on the first pass they got it, but I'm sure that's not true. This takes so much work to just get it just right until you even put a pen to paper in terms of storyboarding and making it come to life visually. So
yeah,
it's really delightful.
But it's an interesting exploration of the whole idea of a living toy and kind of a minimalist.
Wonderful
expression.
Analog. Yeah, exactly. For this incredibly digitally sophisticated film, it's adamantly analog and low tech and handmade.
Pipe cleaners.
Absolutely. It's wonderful. It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, back to the whole mission of the Toy Story films was this assertion that toys really matter to the development of kids. They aren't just merchandise. And of course, Rob, what you said is right, but only we see the toys come alive. None of the humans in the movies do. They behave just like any toy. They totally collapse when the humans come around and have to be moved by them and all that stuff.
Right.
And actually, Forky, one of the beauties of this next part of that assertion that toys are really important to childhood development, Forky thinks he's a piece of garbage because, of course, he was. He was a spork. And he keeps jumping into the garbage. And Woody is the one who has to say, no, we toys will show him how important he is to this child, Bonnie, their new owner. And I can't believe at the beginning of conceiving of Toy Story that anybody would have thought they could sustain it through this. But they not only sustain it, but as I said, I think you'll find anybody who knows children will find it like a pretty touching.
Oh, it's incredibly touching
movement.
Oh, in this installment, I mean, the emotional arc of Woody, it's really complex and serious. And you'll just be a mess. I mean, they worked it all out. It's really wonderful.
Yeah. Anne Hornaday is the film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival and currently an art tourist in West Texas. We'll have more on Midday at the Movies right after a short break. And when we come back, we invite you again to let us know which summer flicks have caught your eye. Join us, 410-662-8780. Midday at WYPR is our email address. And you can tweet us at Midday at WYPR. See you in a bit.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
Welcome back. I'm senior producer Rob Sivak in for Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, it's the Midday News Wrap, and WYPR news anchor Nathan Sterner and his guests will be discussing some of the week's top news developments. From the migrant crisis on the southern border and the growing uproar over Labor Secretary Alex Acosta to the victorious U.S. women's soccer team. All that's coming up tomorrow on the Midday News Wrap with guest host Nathan Sterner, and I hope you'll join us for that. If you're just joining us, this is the July edition of Midday at the Movies, and we are privileged, as always, to be joined by two great aficionados of film. With me here in the studio is Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post and author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. And from the artistic wilds of Marfa in West Texas, Jed Dietz joins us on the line. He's the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Hello again. Are you still there, Jed?
I am indeed.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. And listeners, you can join our conversation today about the new crop of summer movies. Call us at 410-662-8780. You can email us at midday@wypr.org or tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. We'd love to know what kind of summer films you're looking to see this season, and if you've got any favorites that you want to recommend to other folks to catch in their local theaters. Anne and Jed, I wanted to go back quickly to this question about how to do sequels right. Mm. And, you know, there's in addition to Toy Story 4 and, of course, The Lion King, which is not exactly a sequel but a remake, but it's keeping a storyline going, keeping that story alive. Spider-Man comes to mind as mm-hmm. just an example of a really powerful it's a community of fans that loves these films, and I think it's a franchise that it seems to be drawing in a wider audience than mm-hmm. just these hardcore comic fans. I have a clip of the new Spider-Man film, Spider-Man Far From Home. Let's play that and let's talk about how to do sequels right.
They were born in stable orbits. Within black holes, creatures formed from the primary elements, air, water, fire, earth. The science division had a technical name. We just called them elementals.
Versions of them exist across our mythologies.
The elementals are here now, attacking the same coordinates. Our satellites confirm it.
We have one mission, kill it. You're coming with us.
Mr. Fury, this all seems like big time. You know, huge superhero kind of stuff. And I mean, I'm just a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, sir.
Bitch, please, you've been to space.
That's a clip from Spider-Man Far From Home, and it's an endearing character, isn't it?
Totally. This is, as you said, this Spider-Man has gone through so many iterations. I'm old enough to remember the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, which now seem like ancient history, but it seems like, you know, so many different Tobey Maguire played him, and then Andrew Garfield played him, and now we have Tom Holland, who was introduced a few years ago in the movie Homecoming. And what I love about this iteration, the Tom Holland version, is that it's very rooted in high school. These are almost like John Hughes movies, you know? They kind of revive the teen comedy, teen rom-com tropes. Mm-hmm. Zendaya is here as MJ, Mary Jane, who's feisty and kind of doesn't beg to be liked. And so there are a lot
some
of
nice
twists.
Feminist dialogue.
Very
in there too.
Feminist, very woke. This is definitely the wokest Spider-Man of the series. But I just think the comedy is there. It's funny. It's light. it's, I love all the teenage angst and the teenage comedy and banter around it. It's really, when it sticks into that milieu, it's really at its best, and it's just charming.
Yeah. Jed, you said something, and we were talking about the show beforehand, about the way studios don't focus enough on maintaining the quality of the story, and often these sequels are just thrown together and they're put out there to make money, and that's not working in most cases, is it?
That's true, and that goes way back. I mean, the rule of thumb for a long time was any kind of a sequel, whether it was Godfather 2 or Mission Impossible 2, was going to do half the business of the first one, and that was just sort of, you know, an accepted piece of wisdom. And that rule's been broken. I mean, in both directions. I mean, the sequels could do much worse than that because they were not cared for, like the Toy Story or Spider-Man examples. And I would add Harry Potter. I mean, I think we can, listeners may have their own favorite series of films. But I think when they're cared for, and they're freshened, and they're in organic ways that stick to the core mission of the storytelling, and the studios take some chances with new directors, and then I think they can work. And I think there's lots of evidence, and we just mentioned two of them that are playing in theaters right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another summer movie that I think is getting a lot of attention is a film from Danny Boyle, the director.
Yes.
Danny Boyle, Slumdog Millionaire.
He did Slumdog Millionaire, yeah, exactly.
And he's got a new film out called Yesterday, which is in fact a reference to the Beatles song. And could you describe what the premise is here? And you had some issues with this film.
A few. It's actually a very original premise, and a charming one. It was written by Richard Curtis, who a lot of people remember from Love Actually, and he's kind of the king of the rom-coms, you know. He does these very sweet, unashamedly sentimental love stories. And in this story, it's about in the Avengers movies, we had the snap and then the blip. And in this one, we have another blip where over the course of a few minutes, the world goes dark. And when it comes back, nobody can remember who the Beatles were. The Beatles, it's as if the Beatles never existed. And the only person alive who remembers them and their songs is this young singer-songwriter toiling away, busking away in a coastal English town. And when he realizes that no one remembers the songs, he begins to pass... He remembers them, and he begins to pass them off as his own, and he becomes a huge star. And so it's an interesting premise, and it's a chance. You know, this is, in addition to sequels, this has definitely been the summer of boomer nostalgia music movies, you know, with Rocket Man, and we're still coming off the heels of Bohemian Rhapsody. We have a whole raft of documentaries about people like David Crosby and Leonard Cohen, the Laurel Canyon scene. But so this is a chance for us to bask in the Beatles music, performed, I think, really well by this actor, Himesh Patel. He does a beautiful job of just simply singing these lovely tunes.
Who is not a singer-songwriter, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You mean in real life, yeah?
Yeah, in real life, yeah.
Yeah, he just has a very pure, simple voice that I think just does great justice to these songs.
Mm-hmm. We've got some emails here, and let's see. Susan emails, there have been so many films recently about good old music. You mentioned some of them.
Yeah.
Rocket Man, Echo in the Canyon.
Yeah.
What do you know about the upcoming documentary about David Crosby?
Well, I'm hoping to see it soon because I'm actually going to be hosting a Q&A at a screening for the group Oasis, this wonderful late-in-life learning group in Northern Virginia in a couple of weeks. And I've actually heard really good things. You know, he's in the Echo in the Canyon, the Laurel Canyon documentary, and he's irascible. I mean, he's one of those people who will tell you what's on his mind.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling that this is going to it's not going to just be like a nostalgic walk in the park. I think it'll probably have a little edge to it, which is wonderful. You know,
that's
Crosby. Exactly. You want him to be candid, and I think he seems willing to look back on his past and be self-critical. So I'm really, really looking forward to this one.
Gemma in Charles Village emails, Tom Holland is the most woke Spider-Man? I disagree. She's, what about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse?
Oh, yeah.
Miles Morales.
Oh. Very, very well put. I was thinking more Zendaya is the woke character in this franchise. But yes, I will. Tip of the hat. Thank you. That's okay. Well said.
Carol emails us, loved Pavarotti. That's the new Ron Howard documentary, right?
Yes, and this is the one when I'm out and about just socially, this is the one that's really captivating people. And to my shame, I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking forward to seeing it. It's a documentary about the great opera star. And people just, you don't even have to be an opera fan, I think, to really enjoy learning about his life and about his work as a humanitarian.
Luciano Pavarotti was a larger-than-life figure in many ways.
Well, and Ron Howard directs, who is not a big opera fan by his own admission, and I think he starts with what Rob was just saying. I mean, this huge personality of Pavarotti that went way before the opera, beyond the opera art form, and engaged people all over the planet with three tenors and his charity work, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. A few other films I wanted us to get to before we run out of time today is there's a film by director Joe Talbot called Last Black Man in San Francisco. I know it's got it's based on a true story, and it's got the guy that it's about is also the star,
right?
Jimmy Fails. Yeah.
And he and Joe Talbot grew up together in San Francisco. Grew up. I mean, I don't think they were little
they
together,
know each
but
other,
they were very old friends. And Jimmy Fails had this story about the family home, this beautiful Victorian home, that was sort of, it became kind of a metonym, a symbol of everything that they had once and that was lost and that they might be able to get again. And it just has all this kind of emotional freight with it. And my understanding is that they had been talking, Jimmy had shared these stories over the years with Joe Talbot, and they decided to make this movie about it. And it's just this luminous, I think visually extraordinary, just a beautiful lyrical ode to this experience of longing for a home. And then there's a really fascinating turn toward the end that kind of calls a lot of things into question.
Yeah, Jed, you had something to say?
Yeah, well, I agree with everything Ann said. And the other thing I would, I'd mention two quick things. The use of music in this film is just extraordinary, including a version of When You Come to San Francisco with Flowers in Your Hair, a sort of syrupy 60s ballad written by John Phillips, actually, the Mamas and the Papas. But in this movie, it's performed by Michael Marshall, who is a singer in San Francisco, most famous for I Got Five On It, the rap song that appears briefly in Us, in a very important sort of moment in Us, the movie Us. But it's with tuba from a Norwegian jazz tubist who I'd never heard of, named Daniel Herskedal. And I just think that moment alone expresses everything that Anne was saying about the freshness of this film. This is a first-time filmmaker, so you're now so out of the studio system and so into a completely different artistic vision. There's a Joni Mitchell song in it. I mean, the music is just great. You know, the last thing I would say is look for Jello Biafra, formerly with the Dead Kennedys as a cynical tour guide. And you get a picture of what's happening in San Francisco that worries Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails.
Let's hear a little piece of the trailer on this. Gives you a sense of the energy. This is from The Last Black Man in San Francisco.
I always come back to the old house. What if it's empty? What if we just peeked inside?
We could throw parties. You can put on one of your plays. We could yell.
It is this house.
Our old house.
That's not your old house, and that's not your neighborhood.
A little clip from director Joe Talbot's Last Black Man in San Francisco, which is That is playing, that right now is at the Charles, I believe, here in Baltimore. Another film that you mentioned, Anne, is Booksmart. Something that has not gotten a huge amount of attention, but it's hanging in at the theaters. What's special about that movie?
This is a movie that was written years ago. This is one of those scripts that was that's been hanging around for a long time, and they've kind of reworked it and reworked it. And it's a buddy comedy. It's a high school buddy comedy. It's a very familiar scenario. It's the last day of school, and these two nerds who've been grinds for 4 years want to finally party with their peers. And it's a night of debauchery. It's similar to Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Dazed and Confused and Superbad. And as a matter of fact, in this case, the twist is that it's two young women. And one of the actresses, Beanie Feldstein, is the sister of Jonah Hill, who was in Superbad. So there's this lineage there. But it's a kind of a delightful reframing of that narrative through the eyes of two young women. A directorial debut from the actress Olivia Wilde, who I think it gets off to, like, there's a little bit of unevenness at the start, but then she kind of hits her stride and it becomes this very graceful. I just think there are sequences in this film that are so beautifully choreographed and beautifully captured. It's funny, it's touching. I thought there's a lot of value to it, and I really hope that audiences managed to find it.
Yeah, yeah. Jed, you were mentioning John Waters' new book as being a sort of a chock full of stuff about films. It might be a great summer read in between summer movies. You could dive into John Waters' new book, Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Filth Elder. What's special about the book?
Well, it's a chronicle of many things in John's life, sort of looking back on parts of his life. The thing that I think for our listeners would be most interesting are the sections on the movies he made as he progressed from, you know, very independent films, you know, Multiple Maniacs and Pink Flamingos, with very little funding. And therefore great freedom from his standpoint, both in making and marketing the movies. I mean, he literally came up with taglines for marketing campaigns and stuff like that, right through, you know, Serial Mom and movies where he was working with, you know, big name actors and studio financing, and that's a whole other world. And he describes all of those things in unique John Waters fashion, full of insight, full of wisdom about the reality of making art, this art form, in the midst of all the, you know, commercial pushes and pulls around it. I have read the book and also listened to most of it on a road trip I took. Mm-hmm. And John does.
Oh, he narrates
book.
It.
So
that's better than any movie in theaters right now.
That would be entertaining in and of itself. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I would recommend doing both, but take your pick. It's a lot of fun.
So there's another movie that I saw being advertised, and I think it's playing it also at the Charles. It's a Swedish horror flick called Midsommar. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I grew up watching Ingmar Bergman films.
There you go.
And and so I have a thing for Swedish movies, but I'm not sure this is a pretty.
I might gently turn you away from this one. I mean, there are definitely lots of Bergman references in this film.
It's kind of a shocking. It's a shocking.
It sets
horror
out
film.
To be a shocking horror film. Yeah, this is by a young filmmaker named Ari Oster, who made a very promising debut last summer with another horror movie called Hereditary, that featured a truly electrifying
Hereditary
performance by Toni Collette. Mm-hmm. With that movie, I mean, this young man has a real gift for establishing environments and atmospheres, casting for sure, and directing great performances, and ratcheting up tension. I mean, he has all those elements in place. I think with Hereditary, it fell apart in this crucial third act. And the same thing happens here. I think he does all of that here. He establishes this amazing sense of environment in this strange rural Swedish town that is undergoing, that is taking part in a once every 90 years strange ritual, and this group of American young adults comes to observe, and they get drawn in.
Who was that actress?
Florence Pugh, who was really terrific in a movie called Lady Macbeth a few years ago. Yeah. Again, all those elements are in place, but I just think same problem with Hereditary. It just doesn't, he can't make it coalesce, and I just think it kind of goes into strangeness for its own sake, shock for its own sake, graphic body horror for its own sake, and it lost. Unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, it really did lose me. I just didn't think he had the ideas to support, but there is some real instinctive natural talent there, and I hope he'll keep at it, and I hope he'll, you know, ballast some of this stuff with some really, really good ideas.
Yeah. A more uplifting theme in Andrei Paunov's Walking on Water, a documentary about the Last Christo Project. Jed, you've seen that, right?
Yeah, I have. And that's at the Parkway. And it's, Christo is this really unusual artist who has done only tremendous scaled projects like wrapping the Reichstag or the Pont Neuf in Paris or surrounding islands in Miami with a cloth.
The gates in Central Park, I remember that
the
one.
The gates in Central Park, for sure. Mm-hmm. Running Fence, I think, was the first of his big projects that got made into a documentary. And this may be the last of his projects. Just he's in his 80s. These projects take a huge amount of time. This had been worked on for 15 years in various locations, and he finally got Italian authorities to approve creating this thing. What he talked about was a floating pier in Lake Iseo in northern Italy that then the public would be invited to experiences with all his projects over a 2 or 3 week period of time, and then they disappear. Mm-hmm. And this one, logistically, it was really fraught because he really wanted on the water to build this floating deck that people, tens of thousands of people, could walk on and go out to an island and sort of just explore, and then it would go away, and the island would then once again be only available by boats and stuff. Part of his art is implementing it. So you see him involved thousands of people, whether they're politicians or local bureaucrats who have to approve permits or volunteers who help along the way. And it's inspirational to see a guy who really sees art as a way to change the world, not just by the aesthetic, but by the making of it.
Yeah.
And, when you're doing a painting in your studio, you really can't involve lots of other people. But in this scale, you have to. And it's an amazing thing to see, knowing about this guy's life and all the projects we just mentioned.
Yeah.
And to see him do this project, and it's beautiful looking.
Yeah, Walking on Water, the film about the Last Christo Project. We're going to have to wrap it up, I'm afraid. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Hornaday is film critic for The Washington Post, and the author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies, available, of course, in paperback. Thanks to both of you for being with us again, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Rob.
A community.
Fun, thanks.
Oh, thanks, Jed. And good luck. Safe driving in West Texas.
Yeah. Thank you.
A community movie note before we go to break. AVAM's 2019 season of Flicks from the Hill kicks off tonight with a free 9 p.m. outdoor screening of The Sound of Music, preceded by a sing-along and costume parade. You can enjoy all the drinks and eats from local restaurants with ticket purchases, and all proceeds go to the benefit of the American Visionary Art Museum. We'll have more info on our website at wypr.org/midday. Coming up after a quick break, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick joins me with her review of a classic children's book turned musical, now on stage at the Olney Theater Center. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.